Hi everyone, my name is Adam Small.
And I'm Jake Moses.
Welcome to our podcast, The Performer's Pathway.
A podcast adventure to help guide and navigate your musical life and career.
As a prelude to every episode, we'd like to remind our listeners that this podcast is about the other side of the musical coin. One side, which you see a lot at our website, mymusicmasterclass.com, is what to do in the practice room. And the other side is how to maximize your talent and skills in the real world, and that's what this podcast is about. Also, if you have a few extra seconds to spare,
which is technically only 3 beats at 60 BPM,
please subscribe to our show on your podcast app of choice and rate us 5 stars. You can leave a comment about absolutely anything too, and we hope you do. This small act of kindness will really help us expand our audience and continue to create new episodes.
And lastly, word of mouth is always super helpful. So if you like what you hear, please tell the world.
All right, everyone. So we are here for a very special episode with Dr. Don Green. He's a peak performance psychologist. He does a lot with musicians. He's taught his techniques at Juilliard School, Colburn School, the New World Symphony, amongst many others. He's been practicing for 32 years, and he's coached more than 1,000 performers to win professional auditions. He's guided countless solo performers to really successful careers, and we're super happy to have him, especially in this time of uncertainty. How are you doing, Dr. Green?
I'm doing fine, Adam. Thanks. Nice to be with you.
You know, I know that you've been doing a lot of talks, I'm sure, about COVID. I actually saw you do something on Facebook, and that's something that we're all dealing with. So we're going to stray back into the realm of, imagine that the world was running smoothly at the moment. And we're going to talk about some of the things that you do often before the bomb dropped on the world at the moment. So let's start with peak performance. A lot of musicians, and I know this is something that Jake and I have talked about a lot on the podcast, feel that what they do in the practice room always sounds better than when they get to the stage. And I know this is a big, big can of worms. And I'm sure this is not only in your wheelhouse, but probably what you deal with majority of the time. So how do we bridge this disconnect of what you do in the practice room to what you're doing on the stage?
Great question. There's a progression, a sequence of events, such as learning, from learning to performing, from left brain to right brain, from practice room to stage. And it needs to be a progression. First, you need to learn the skills and be able to do them very well in the practice room. But that's under ideal conditions. And you need to be able to do it first under ideal conditions before you move to less than ideal conditions, like live performances and auditions, because those are not ideal conditions. Mm-hmm. And people can practice in a practice room in one state of mind and at one energy level. And then all of a sudden, when they're on stage or in an audition, they move to a different mindset and a different energy level. And it's different than what they've been doing in the practice room. And chances are, it's not going to sound very good at first. So the idea is to master the skills in ideal conditions and then put yourself under increasing pressure, more consequences, one take at a time, not you can stop and start, and with higher energy levels that you'd be feeling at an audition after the adrenaline kicks in. Mm-hmm. Practicing under those circumstances. Otherwise, it's like practicing on one instrument and then switching before you go into the audition to a different instrument or different bow.
I see.
So the whole idea is, after you master the skills in the practice room, then you put yourself under increasing pressure to the point that you realize that you may not be as comfortable under those high-pressure situations. But the reality of the matter is, what I teach is that people can learn how to perform better because of the extra energy, for increased presence, increased intensity, really being on and thriving under pressure versus just trying to make it sound like it does in the practice room, which I think is a waste of time. So that's how I approach it. If you look at Olympic athletes who, well, until this summer, compete every 4 years, and these athletes used to compete regularly all the time, in national championships, regional championships, Pan Am Games, World University Games, Maccabee Games. But it's only once every 4 years when not only do the Olympic records fall, but the world records fall because all the athletes are under amazing pressure. But they've been taught for years by sports psychologists like me to do better because of it, to jump higher, run faster, all those things. And I look at auditions as athletic events, high energy competition. And it's not about just getting through and making it sound like, okay, that's the way I sound in a practice room. That's not going to get you a job. That's not going to help you stand out versus the 100 other talented and trained musicians at the audition. You need to light them up. And you do that with adrenaline and with energy, just like Olympic athletes learn to do.
So that kind of bridges me into something else I was thinking that I'm sure you could expound on. So fear, there's this misconception that successful musicians, they don't have a relationship with fear, right? But I believe, and I maybe I'm wrong, but that a lot of musicians, or most musicians, do have fear, but they utilize that in the right way, like you're saying, as an energy to fuel them. Like, for instance, I know that there's plenty of famous musicians who've battled with stage fright. You would never know. They say, no, I'm still frightened every time I get on the stage. There's people in boxing and MMA say that I hate fighting. I hate it, but they're undefeated. So they use that to thrive in some way. So I know that this exists in that world. Does this resonate? Does this make sense?
Absolutely, because what's under the anxiety is fear. Whether it's fear of failure, fear of success, fear of embarrassment, whatever you call it. But it goes with the territory. I tell musicians if they don't want to feel fear, well, just stay at home.
Right.
Of course, I don't want to say that now.
Yeah, exactly.
So the fear goes with the territory. And the idea is to learn how to embrace the fear and make it work for you. The fear is a result, and adrenaline is a result of a perceived threat. To perceive threat of real physical danger, or perceive threat of looking like a fool mm-hmm. in front of an orchestra. And fear is fear, and whatever triggers the adrenaline, it doesn't matter. If you perceive it as a threat, if you perceive the angry conductor who's looking at you as a threat, it doesn't matter if it's somebody pointing a real gun at you or just an angry conductor looking at you saying, could you play that again, please?
Right.
And then the adrenaline kicks in. And once the adrenaline kicks in, this whole myriad of symptoms cascade into your body and brain that prepare you for fight or flight or freeze. But if you fight it, if you interpret it wrong, namely, oh my God, not now, please not now, it's going to have adverse effects. Versus if you train for it and get used to recognize that some of the symptoms are helpful. And some of them are not helpful. Okay, the adrenaline, that can be helpful. Okay, others are non-consequential unless you make them consequential. In other words, butterflies in your stomach. Well, that's not in your head. That's in your stomach. That's the acid being released in your stomach, and you feel it. And you can interpret that as, oh my God, now I'm going to die. Whatever. Or changes in breathing. These things need not affect you. But muscle tension, because people brace for the attack, and that causes problems in any athletic movement or any musical movement, because you have to move to produce music, whether it's movement of air or a bow across the strings. It takes energy to do that, but tight muscles restrict that movement. And oftentimes the difference between what happens in a practice room and on stage is tight muscles. That people are relaxed, relatively relaxed muscularly in a practice room, but then they go on stage and they get progressively tighter and tighter and tighter. And that's going to affect their movement. The bow. Okay. All of a sudden, instead of nice flowing bow movement, full extension that they hear in a practice room, now it's cut off and it's choppy. And they hear that and that causes them to tighten up more and more. So that's a task relevant cue. That's really important that they pay attention to the muscular tension, not to the butterflies in their stomach. The other thing is what happened mentally, because in a practice room, people are not worried about what others are thinking of them or paying attention to them or if they're going to like it. And all of a sudden now they're, rather than being focused on the music, they're focused on the audition panel or the conductor or their stand partner. And they get very self-conscious. They tend to get very self-critical. They tend to doubt themselves. Again, these produce negative consequences, which affect their playing. And then you got more threat, namely, if this continues, they'll take me out and shoot me. It gets progressively worse. So the whole idea is to anticipate these kind of things in a practice room and learn how to focus beyond them, learn how to play at high energy, learn how to play past mistakes, learn to play with all sorts of noise around you. Put some talk radio stations on and TV station and play past that. Learn how to focus, because you can learn how to play better with distractions than if there are no distractions after you get used to it. So these are the type of things to do to take it not only to the practice room and make it okay on stage, but make it better on stage, although it may not be as comfortable. If you want comfort, stop playing in public. There's no help. It's dealing with the uncomfortableness. Because mm-hmm. what I offer musicians the option of, would you rather win the audition and be uncomfortable, or be comfortable and not get past the prelims? So it's a choice. And athletes are trained to be uncomfortable. My military background, Special Forces, Airborne School, Ranger School, I was taught how to be miserable for extended periods of time and focus on the mission, focus on the task at hand. That's basically it.
It's funny. I have a lot of Israeli friends in Los Angeles and New York. And at one point, one of my Israeli friends that's a musician, he said, touring's easy. You know, I was in the army, you know. He's like, I bunk. He's like, you can bunk with people. I have no problem with it. I adapt. You overcome. You figure it out.
That's it. I learned something in the military that might be very helpful, especially for musicians who are still indoors or in metropolitan areas, and you can't go out, and you can't play with your friends, you can't, the whole thing, and you got to basically stay inside. Well, I was trained to do that. It's called hunker down. That's the military. I know how to hunker down. I lived in New York City, and in the winter times, other than going to Juilliard, I could hunker down and order in food every night. I love that. I entered West Point July 1st, my freshman year, and you're not allowed to leave the campus, the immediate surroundings under extreme punishment, until Army-Navy game, which was in November. It's not just staying in your room, it's also getting hazed and yelled at constantly.
Right.
So being inside for extended periods of time, fine with me.
You should have been practicing violin the entire time, you see? That would have done it. While getting yelled at and hazed by a drill sergeant.
Did you say violin?
Yeah, whatever it was, yeah, exactly.
Well, actually, I grew up playing guitar.
Right.
With the Beatles and the Stones. Not lead, but I can play chords. Mm-hmm. And I can sing. Not good, but I can sing. Mm-hmm. And that was my hobby all through high school. I was a diver, and that was my profession. But mm-hmm. I liked to play, and I taught myself guitars. But those first 5 months at West Point, you weren't allowed to have a guitar or music in your room. Oh, and that just drove me crazy.
Yeah, you need that release.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, I understand what you're saying. It makes complete sense, and it's things that Jake and I have talked about on the podcast. It's kind of this compounding of events that just leads to a decision that you have to make to be conscious of sometimes, right? Like if you're tightening up, like you said, at that point your circulation might be getting a little cut off, your hands start getting cold, whatever happens, and you go down this rabbit hole of this is going down, this is a bad thing. So is there anything you can do? Because there are some things that we can control. For instance, breath is involuntary, but we can't control it. Are there breathing exercises that you would advise people to do either before or during performances, or to just listen to your breath?
Absolutely. Slow and deep breathing consciously in and of itself will lower anxiety levels. Okay, there's all sorts of studies proving this. The strategy I use is called centering. It's tied to breathing, it's tied to shifting from left brain to right brain, from the analytical mind to the creative musical state of mind, also quieting the mind and focusing on the task at hand. It's a complicated procedure. I teach it through my website. I've got a course on it because you can't learn it in a day. It takes about 2 weeks. But there are audio tapes, there's a workbook and videotapes. And in 2 weeks, you can learn how to center down and also center up. Because once people learn how to control their energy and realize that they can perform better with the energy, they stop wanting to bring it down as much and they want to start bringing it up. The reason I got interested in this subject is because I was diagnosed with a speech impediment when I was 4 years old. And I had trouble pronouncing certain sounds, like the GR sound. And that would have been okay if my last name was White. But when people asked my name, I told them, they started laughing. So by the time I got to kindergarten or first grade, I stopped talking. I hated being called on in class. I did everything I could, and I got filled with anxiety when I was called upon. And this lasted all through high school and college. My senior year at West Point, I had to give a short presentation on Che Guevara, revolutionary. That was my major, revolutionary warfare. And I prepared extensively for the week before. I couldn't sleep. I went up, and he's in front of my classmates that I went through 4 years of hell at West Point with, my buddies. And I stood up, had my notes in front of them. I couldn't see them. I blanked out. I stuttered. I got flushed red in the face. And somehow I managed to finish and graduate. And I went through graduate school, but I didn't have to do a lot of presentations in graduate school. But after graduate school, I figured I needed to learn how to do this just personally. I was 28, 29 years old then. And I went to a Toastmasters in San Diego. And Toastmasters is where you get with other scared to death people at a conference room with your brown bag lunch. And all you have to do is say your name and where you're from. But everybody's from San Diego anyway. So I sat down and they're going around the conference room one by one. And before they got to me, I left. So about a year later, I started into a sports psychology program, and I learned how to control my energy. I learned centering from the man who invented it, Dr. Bob Nidecker, who had the same kind of issues until he went to Japan and got a black belt in Aikido, came back to the States, got a PhD in sports psychology, and connected the dots of what happens to everybody. It's the same for everybody. Mm-hmm. My dissertation was training SWAT officers to perform under stress in a stress shooting course. So I spent a lot of time with these SWAT officers. Half of them I taught centering, the other half I didn't, but I spent a lot of time with them. They're scared as everybody else, and most of them are athletes. And I started talking to them, what are your fears? Well, we have a softball team and it's getting up there and striking out again. That's what I'm afraid. So it's universal. Just about everybody experiences fear other than psychopaths. Psychopaths aren't concerned with consequences or their conscience, so they don't care. There's a book called The Wisdom of Psychopaths that explains this. I don't recommend the book. I don't know many musicians that are psychopaths. Hopefully or any. Not. I don't.
So talking about your public speaking thing, that kind of brings me to another thought process, which is that there are many musicians that are very in the zone when they're playing. They can pull that off beautifully, and it's almost as if they're in a trance or a meditative state. But if they have to do any public speaking, they freak out.
That's the catch with musicians, okay? And singers, the same category, in the same category. This is because the left brain is what talks. The right brain is what plays music. Okay? And the vast majority of musicians, after you learn the skills in left brain, spend all your time in right brain, you know, hearing it, playing it, hearing it, feeling the bowing, feeling the air. But you can hang out in right brain for a considerable amount of time. Unless something goes wrong, then you got to check in with your left brain and then hopefully get quick back on track in right brain. But speaking is words, and that's the left brain. That's the analytical verbal side of the brain that does calculations, that does talking. Okay. So when I was with New World Symphony, we would take them through mock auditions, and I purposely had them start by saying their name your instrument and talk for about 30 seconds or whatever about the piece or the composer. And that freaked him out. Just let me play. Please let me play. But I learned from watching a lot of auditions, particularly with opera singers, that the audition panel, especially if you're going to be with their company for a month or with their orchestra, they want to get a glimpse into your personality. They want to get to know you, whether you're going to be good to work with or good to train, whatever. So they love this. And it's like chorus line. They want to get a glimpse into your personality. And people that are not used to doing this freeze.
Right.
And they don't sound natural. It's not rehearsed. It sounds like it's not rehearsed. They sound like an amateur. And then they start playing and they sound like a pro. So I highly recommend that musicians practice this a lot. Not as much as their music, but to catch up somewhat and videotape it. It can be very uncomfortable at first to watch yourself do this, but this is part of your act. And with the amount of time you spend practicing your instrument, to drop an audition in the first 30 seconds and before you even play, like, I don't necessarily want to hear this person. I don't want them in my company. And that's why it's really important to practice this. Or get a coach. This is something I coach people on over and over and get it right. And it's uncomfortable at first. Just let me play. No, let's learn how to do your act right and over until you're really happy with it. Then you have a great product. It
makes a lot of sense.
You could also just crash weddings and just do speeches.
Yeah, but you get to do it without toasting. That's a cushion. Good idea.
A lot of people just have trouble with bad habits as far as, you know, caffeine and stuff like that. So I was going to kind of ask, when do you know if you have to really kind of change a habit? If you're drinking too much coffee, if you're eating the wrong kind of stuff, like when, because that can affect performance like crazy.
Or alcohol.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Alcohol.
It's an athletic event, just like any other one. You want to be in not only mental shape, but physical shape. And so, yes, you train for it. That's why I don't like beta blockers anymore than I would have Olympic swimmers drink vodka before their race. It drops the energy, that vital energy. You need that for focus and intensity and presence. So I know because of the pandemic, people tend to drift in, some people, into not so good habits. And that comes along with the initial shock and denial. And it's a way to cushion that. But after a certain reasonable amount of time and catching up more on sleep and cleaning your apartment or your house and catching up on things, you need to see if it's serving you. It's serving your best interest as a musician. I'm working with a lot of folks all over the world, musicians, and it's real easy to sink into a depression and not feel like practicing at all, not feel like even getting out of bed. I'm working with a concertmaster who struggles to get out of bed, let alone practice Paganini every day. Mm-hmm. I think it's important to recognize that and allow yourself some cushion and be gentle with yourself. Not feel guilty about it. Realize that this is part of the depression that we're all in the middle of. It's not chronic depression. It's situational depression because of the situation, which zaps people energy, puts you in a bad mood, don't feel like practicing, don't feel like talking, don't feel like anything. And you can get stuck in that pit for too long. And if you realize you're stuck in that pit or you're drinking too much coffee or too much whatever, my recommendation is to pull yourself out of that pit, not push yourself out with guilt and come on, you got to do this, you dog, and set goals. And my recommendation is, this is a terrible situation, but it's not going to last forever. And I feel that I love music and I miss live music. I miss opera. I miss concerts. And I'm not the only one.
Yep, people, us too.
People, especially, I'm talking about the public that are waiting to fill those concert halls and Broadway companies again. And I think there's going to be more of a clamoring for live music than ever before. I think everybody's booked to the max. Okay.
I hope so.
I'm not sure if that's going to happen in a year, but it's going to happen. And my feeling is most musicians never have enough time to practice, never enough time to sleep, never enough time to work on other repertoire, not enough time to play music, they really enjoy playing. So this to me is a great opportunity to take advantage of this, or you can just let it go by. So my recommendation is this. You set a year goal, a year from now, and you're going to give a performance, a concert, an audition, unless there really is one, then you can then do it. And if you do it right, in a year from now, you should be playing the best of your life. And if it's an audition and you do this right, you're going to be competing against musicians who haven't practiced for a year. Mm-hmm. And people are going to lose auditions and lose tenure when they come back, or not gain tenure, because they just sunk into this pit. So my feeling is to pull you out of the pit and get you moving, because that's the antidote to depression, is you got to move. You got to take action. And the first thing, set the one-year goal, you got to give a performance and set reasonable but challenging goals. You got a year to prepare. Mm-hmm. Full time. So that's number one. And I suggest you set four types of goals. Outcome goals, you know, that you're going to nail it, you're going to win the audition or whatever. Process goals, what you need to do playing-wise to achieve those outcomes. Practice goals, the structure of your practice, because that's really important. I'm going to come back to that one. And the fourth is mental goals, that you can also improve your psyche, your mental skills, your focus ability, your recovery from mistakes, your mental toughness, just as well as your physical skills. So you set all of those and you write them out. And then what you do is you work backwards, like to 9 months, 6 months, 3 months, and 1 month goal. And you set the same, but progressively, you know, moving forward. So you have a ramp up to those, not just you accomplish them in the first month. But then what you do is you have a performance at 6 months, 3 months, 1 month, and you do it for colleagues, principals, teachers, fans, and it's one take. It's live, one take. No two takes. You record it, one take. Okay? So then you build back from that, from the 1 month to the 4 weeks. And at the every Saturday, you have a recording. You record yourself. You can do it for other people. And then based upon that, you set your 5 days of structure to have a great performance on Saturday. Hopefully you can take off Saturday or Sunday. The problem for a lot of musicians is that they used to live a very structured life. Rehearsals, lessons, practices, performances, really regimented. And now it's gone.
Yeah.
And people that are used to structure and live flounder. And what do? And you can waste the whole day. 5 o'clock, I didn't do a thing today. What did I do? Nothing. So this is a way to put structure back in your life, because most of you thrive with structure and flounder without it. So I recommend a routine. And I'll give you what mine is, and it may be the same, you can adapt it. But it's based upon the best times of the day and your energy levels, because it all revolves around energy, because this situation can zap your energy and then you don't feel like doing anything. So sleep is very important. And if you caught up on sleep, it's important that you get enough sleep without overdoing it. But the ideal I recommend is 9 hours. There's a study of highly functioning people saying that's ideal. And this is a great time to get 9 hours. You may not have had 9 hours your whole adult life. And if you start doing this,
especially if you have a child, you definitely don't get 9 hours.
Yeah. You may be the best you have in 10 years just by doing this. Okay. Other people are having insomnia, so I'd be careful about taking too much sleep medication, which is natural sleep. So I recommend that you try to go to bed at the same time and get up at the same time every day as much as possible. Fight the tendency to watch late night and late night and binge watch.
Yeah.
A month ago, or 2 months, whenever that was, I had a subscription to Netflix. I used it once in months and months. Now I'm binge watching Breaking Bad.
That's just the tip of the iceberg. Better Call Saul, you know, that comes right after Breaking Bad. That's a good one.
And it was one of my musicians who told me to watch it.
It's very it's very addictive.
I know. It's the word. So, try to get up at about the same time. But here's the routine I would recommend. And most musicians I've recommended to really like this. It takes about a week to get used to. Within about 5 or 10 minutes after you wake up, you go to the bathroom and you splash cold water in your face 7 times at least. Now, what this does is it shocks your system, sends a wave of energy up your spine, and releases endorphins. Runner's high. You don't have to run a marathon, just 7 minutes. The other thing is that the splashing releases negative ions into the air. Negative ions are better than positive. Those are the free radicals. Negative ions, because the molecules of water bounce across each other, they release these negative ions and release serotonin in the brain, which puts you in a good mood. That's why when you sit by a waterfall in Hawaii or by the surf, you're in a good mood. You don't have to go to Hawaii. You can stay in your room and these happy chemicals. So then what I'd recommend is try to go outside to get some fresh air and sunlight, which counts as depression and gets you moving, and stretch. Get your body supple. Just get it loose. Then take a brisk 5-minute walk or jog. Not for aerobics, just to get the metabolism going and to wake you up and get you moving. I recommend also a playlist, a musical playlist to get you moving in the morning or get you in a good mood. And it can be any music you like, but there's studies to show that whether it's classical, opera, hip-hop, rock and roll, the ones that put you in the best mood are your favorite songs, whatever they are.
That makes sense.
But there's a song that's been researched to prove that it releases happy chemicals into your brain. And I listen to that song every day 3 times before I do anything. And it's Bill Withers' Lovely Day.
You couldn't have picked a better tune. man, I miss that guy. He was a genius.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was about 2 months ago.
Yeah.
And it started when he was in his 40s or something. He was a laborer or something. He worked at docks in L.A. Isn't that awesome?
That's just one of the best. It's one of the best. I mean, and it's so raw in the production. I love it.
Yeah. And so simple.
Mm-hmm.
And you watch him play guitar and they tuned it differently. All he does is borrow some strings.
I mean, he was a genius writer. Lean on Me was also great. And as is Ain't No Sunshine, they were all just great. He was a great, great writer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great stuff.
Okay, so your own musical playlist, and also to get you going, my song to get me going is either Rocky or Top Gun.
Absolutely.
Iron Tiger and the Battle of the Green Berets. And I'm like, oh, yeah.
Exactly. Top Gun. Highway to the Danger Zone.
Oh, yeah. So then I'd recommend that you come in and sit down and become mindful or just check in. What's going on? Just sit there quietly. How's your body feeling? What's on your mind? What's going on? And what do you need to do today? What are the 3 most important things as a musician that you need to do today? Write them down. You know, work on Etude Book 14 or work on a concerto. And what you intend to do. And then imagine them. Hear it. Feel yourself playing them till you're satisfied. Then be grateful. Count your blessings. In spite of this tragedy, we all have lots to be grateful for. So then you start your day. It only takes about maybe 10 or 15 minutes extra, but it starts your day with structure, which is really important. Okay. Then it depends upon your best hours. Musicians tend to have later hours than me, but my best hours in the morning are like 8 to 11 or 9 to 12. This is when I write. This is when I do my creative work. This is when I'm at my best. But I chunk those 3 hours into 3 parts because you can only focus for about 45 or 50 minutes anyway. When you get tired, you need to take a break. So that's you take a 5 or 10 minute break and you do something else, totally unrelated. Make some phone calls, work on your instrument, pay some bills, refresh your mind, go outside, breathe. Jump up and down, come back and continue the first chunk in line with your goals, or a different chunk, and then a third chunk. So to me, those are my best 3 hours of the day. I can't be as good. Okay, so then you take hopefully a lunch break, but you're not going out with your friends and eat some lunch, so this can be fairly short.
at this point.
And then you come back to my next hour is fairly low key as I'm digesting the food. My energy drops and I need a break. This is when I might watch the news, but you have to watch over watching the news. That's an addiction.
It's a
too.
Horror movie right there.
Continuing horror movie. Fight that tendency. I have a friend that I watch for, and I say if you know something tragic happens, I'll let sleep
the news. If there's an air raid siren, you're gonna call.
So something light, but then you've got another three or four chunks in the afternoon, and these to me need to be different. I'd say 1 hour or 20 minutes for exercise. At least 20 minutes or more. It's really important at this point that you keep your immune system up and your state of health, and you may not feel like it, but go out there and get going, yeah. Get moving. Put some good music on and get moving. That's the solution. I spent a good amount of time on the couch right after this happened, and I had to hold a gun to my head to get moving.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But it's death. I mean, it's really death if you stay there, okay? And it's time for everybody. It's way past time for everybody.
Yeah, you got to make your own intervention.
Really, really. So this in the old Wild West, this guy sitting next to a campfire at night, drinking a cup of coffee, and this guy comes up on horseback. He says, "Can I join you?" The guy says, "Sure, sit down. Glad to have you." He says, "I have some whiskey here. Why don't you have a shot?" He says, "No, I'd rather not." He says, "No, I insist." He says, "No, I'd just rather have coffee." So he takes out his gun, he holds the gun to the guy's head. He says, "Drink." So the guy takes a shot. He hands him the gun. He says, "Now you make me drink."
Well, that sounds like the Deer Hunter. I don't know.
Yeah. So in the afternoon, in these chunks, you want some exercise, and you also want to recreate. You want to do something that's fun. This is laborious enough as it is, and people in a bad mood. So you really want to do something fun. And one of the things I'd suggest is some comedy movies or some stand-up. There's this man named Norman Cousins you may have heard of. Mm-hmm. In 1964, he was 49 years old. He was a writer, an editor of a magazine like Time Magazine. He had no health problems other than when he was a teenager. He had diagnosed with congenitive heart problems, but never caused him much problems. Until at 49, he got this rare disease, Cautis, and it's got a long name I can't pronounce, but it attacks the connective tissue in the spinal cord.
Yikes.
It eats away at it, and it's extremely painful, in most cases, fatal. So he was sent in the hospital in LA, and the doctors told him to get his affairs in order, like, you don't have much time. So for 2 months, he was in the hospital in excruciating pain and getting worse. After 2 months, he said, "I've had enough of this. I'm checking out." Checked out on his way home, he bought a movie projector and comedy movies. Marx Brothers, Laurel and Hardy. And every day he watched until he was laughing out loud for hours, and the pain went away. He could sleep for the first time without any pain. And he kept on watching the movies, and he healed himself. No pain.
Sounds like a prescription for laughter is the best medicine, right?
Well, that's just it. He founded a department at UCLA Medical School on laughter as therapy. And now there's laughter clubs where people get together and laugh.
Makes sense.
And it doesn't matter if you fake it laugh or laugh, it releases the same happy chemicals. So what I do is every morning, besides listening to Bill Withers, I watch previous night's comedy hour, like Late Show, Stephen Colbert, Seth Meyers, until I'm laughing out loud, because if I start writing in a bad mood, it just comes out sarcastic.
That's right.
I want to do, so I got to get myself in a mood, and sometimes it takes me a half an hour, but then I start writing, and I think especially now, this is a real good time as part of recreation, is to catch up on stand-up comedians. There's a ton of them out there, and they're on Netflix.
Yeah.
That's one thing I'd certainly do. I'd spend some time maybe then or in the evening connecting with good friends. This is the time to catch up on phone or emails. I've been talking to my old college roommate that I haven't talked to in too many years, and we're catching up on old times like that. And I just found out the name of my old girlfriend from college who I haven't talked to since I graduated, and that should be interesting.
There you go.
So these kind of things that you do every day as part of the structure in the afternoon to make yourself productive. Because here's the thing, a year from now, you can, if you follow a structure and set this up right that works for you, you can be the best musician of your life, and you'll probably never have this opportunity again. Set up the structure, figure out how you're going to do it. If you want to take more lessons, you can take a lesson with a principal that would never maybe see you before. Now he or she is sitting at home just like you are. Mm-hmm. You can read books you've been reading, meaning to read, etude books, working on repertoire you haven't had a time to do. This is a time to physically, mentally, emotionally make yourself better as a musician.
It makes a lot of sense. You want to make this time precious, not a prison sentence.
Yeah, because it's not unless you make it worse by right. not taking advantage of it and getting in a bad mood and going into a hole in a cave, right. which is easier for guys to do than women. I know this one very well, but fight the tendency. Again, mobilize. Get yourself moving. Mm-hmm. Avoid avoidance.
Yeah, I hear you. You know, there's an interesting, and this is a separate topic, but I wrote it down because I just thought that this was a good point that musicians face a lot. Kind of an imposter syndrome kind of vibe, you know, and I know you know what that is, and my wife's a therapist, so I know what it is now. But meaning to the audience that you might be famous or you've had a certain amount of success, but you always think that you're faking it to a certain degree, or you're not deserving, right? How do you overcome that, and do you see a lot of that?
I see a lot of that.
Yeah.
And it blows me away because I work mostly with elite athletes and musicians.
Right.
It almost doesn't matter. In the 90s, the magazine Psychology Today did a survey of all top professionals, all people with diplomas on the wall, certified public accountants, attorneys who passed the bar, surgeons, these credentialed people. And over half of them thought they were imposters, that someday they'd be found out.
Right.
Yeah. It's mind-blowing. But it's human nature. None of us are perfect. We all have deficits in our playing and our whatever. None of us are perfect, and we're well aware of our deficits. And under pressure, we become increasingly aware, and they tend to manifest. Okay. So I always ask my musicians a reverse psychology test. And I tell them just to listen and answer carefully, but notice their reaction. And it goes something like this. Are you ready, Adam? You want to do this one?
All right, I'm ready for you.
You're not a real musician, are you?
I think I am.
But you haven't been trained, have you?
I did some training, yeah. I went to school and stuff, and you know, I've done a bunch of gigs.
A real school?
I think so. Yeah, yeah, it was a real school, actually. Yeah.
Freshman majors?
Yeah, it was. It was a conservatory.
You probably never practiced, have you?
Yeah, just about 4 hours a day, 6 hours sometimes.
Yeah, but you probably never played in public, have you?
I guess I did.
I've asked a lot of musicians. They kind of hesitated some of those questions. It's like, no, I've got the goods.
Right.
I got the goods. But everybody's experience, everybody, the drop in confidence. You know, you have a bad performance, a bad rehearsal, you know, yeah, nobody's perfect. Yeah. So my recommendation is to take a good deep look at the inner recesses and explore those things that you just got by on in music school, or that your teacher never really called you on that. And this is the time, you know, to take those things up so your confidence is as high as you really are. And that we deservedly is, not the imposter syndrome. But yeah, a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. So on the other end of the spectrum, where's the fine line of, because I know there's going to be a certain dialogue if you want to build confidence and sort of, because you need confidence, especially performance arts. You don't want to be paralyzed by just second questioning everything, you know, but where's that line in your self-dialogue between confidence and like arrogance? Like, can you develop bad, you know, habits with that?
That's a great question. Okay. Confidence comes from your self-talk, positive or negative, your imagery of you being able to imagine yourself doing well, and your practice habits. If any of those are low, your confidence drops. If they're high, your confidence goes up. I find athletes tend to be more arrogant or capable of arrogance than confidence for a lot of reasons. But the definition of arrogance versus confidence is arrogance is the feeling you have right before you mess up.
And then you lose your confidence.
Yeah, then you come back to reality. So that's the thing I like about music. You can't fake it in music. You got to have the goods. It's either there or not. Mm-hmm. And the musician is most well aware of that. So it's kind of a self-correcting kind of mechanism.
So one thing I wanted to say in general is that, you know, we've spoken on this podcast before about the mental side of music, because I know personally how important it is. I've told people many times as a musician and when I was doing consultation for them that someone that has good time, let's say you have good time with a metronome, if you feel that you have good time and you're confident in your time, it will be better than someone who, with the same exact skill set, that doesn't have complete confidence in their time, right? And this is what we're talking about with peak performance. I think, I don't want to put words into your mouth, but in my mind, if you have a set amount of musicians practicing the same things, and let's say I know it's impossible to say this, but let's say they have the exact same skill set. The ones who have their mind together are the ones that are going to excel, right? This is your life. I mean, you're trying to take someone that's at 95% and take them to 100, right? Am I wrong?
No. That's perfection. I take them to 97. Now, Christian, so it's not perfect because I don't believe in perfectionism. And if you go in there looking for perfectionism, the slightest little bobble is going to destroy the system.
That's a good point.
The optimal zone at Wins Auditions is 93 to 97.
Mm.
When everybody else is trying to do 100 and then they get to about 80, mm-hmm. My folks are cruising along at about a 95 and they win.
I would say that that's a really good point. Yeah, because if you're striving for perfection, you're asking for too much, right? It's too much pressure.
You can't do it.
No.
I ask people to sign their name like they're signing a check and then make a perfect replica of it right underneath. It's impossible. And it destroy your flow in writing. All of a sudden look like kindergarten writing. But that's what happens to musicians when they go into prefrontal cortex, they get out of their right brain, go into left brain, start overthinking. That's what causes choking. It's well documented through sports psychology.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is this. You've got two athletes or two musicians, the same training, the same teachers, the same skill level, the same instrument. Which one wins? Who wants it the most? Desire.
Right.
Last person standing in the final super finals. That's what wins. The one who hangs on tenaciously.
Right.
At all costs. And then it becomes like a military operation. You never give up.
You know, that's a great point. And that's also a really good finale to this thing.
Can I make a commercial announcement about the website?
Please do.
I've got a website called winningonstage.com where I have a lot of free blogs and more information about how to deal with the pandemic. But I've got a performance learning course that just came out that I've been working on for a few years. And it's only open for another week and a half. But it is called Power Learning Course. And so all the things I've learned over teaching athletes and musicians and golf schools and music schools, not about performance, but about learning. Because at Juilliard, I found people know how to perform, but they don't necessarily know how to speed up their learning.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a 3 or 4 month self-study course, 5 different areas of study that can dramatically increase their ability to learn, including professionals. Because like we've been talking, even professionals have some blind spots that they kind of work around, and this is time to work on those and again, increase confidence. We've got a VIP part of the course, which has office hours once a month, and we have a VIP exclusive, which is limited, and we only have a few slots left for people who also want one-on-one sessions with me. They're 4 half-hour sessions to talk individually about their learning. Also involves a performance learning assessment, where we measure specifically deficits in learning. Are you too cognitive? Are your practice habits not good? Are you not committed? So we really amp up learning. So 4 months from now, you should have your learning dramatically increased. I've also got the Centering course, which is a self-study course with a workbook and videos to teach the centering strategy, which is my main strategy for controlling energy, shifting to right brain, and winning auditions. I've got other books there and other assessments. And because of the virus, everything on my website is 30% off, including one-on-one sessions with me. So this is the way I feel it can help musicians the most to learn and progress over these next months and year to get better learning, better centering, better focus, improving your mental skills. This is a great time to do it over the next several months, and 30% off first time, and that's going to end fairly soon.
And I think that's great. And I think everyone listening, you know, we have definitely have an audience of professional musicians here. And if any of you out there need any help with this, please go to winningonstage.com and check out Dr. Green's offerings. Thanks so much, Dr. Green. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It's delightful.
Questions, comments, episode ideas, hate mail. You can get in touch with us by contact form, email, or voicemail, all of which are available at our website, theperformerspathway.com. If one of your questions or topics makes it into the podcast, with your consent, of course, you'll receive a shiny new $10 gift card for use at mymusicmasterclass.com. That's our sister website, which contains over 600 original educational videos from your musical heroes. I look forward to hearing from you.